It's so nice to have everybody here this evening. Susan gave a little bit of an intro to the seven factors, but for there are a couple people here who were new to our Buddhist Essentials series, and I wanted to fill in a little bit. So for those of you who come to SIMS regularly, I think it was 4 years ago when we studied the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And then last year we did Dependent Origination. And this year we're studying, each month is a different topic within the framework of Dharma and daily life. So for a lot of practitioners, you know, they kind of go like, what are the hindrances again? And, you know, how do you deal with the factors? And so we, there's seven of us as the local Dharma leaders. And for 9 or 10 months every year on the third Wednesday of the month, we offer a couple hours like we're doing tonight on one of the main parts of the Buddhist teachings. So the seven factors are part of the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. One of you wrote that you had just finished Joseph's book on the four foundations. And the first foundation, of course, is the foundation of the body. And the second is Vedana, or the feeling tones. And the third is the mind. And the fourth is called the Dhammas, or the various categories of experience. And within that section, there's like a lot of Buddhist lists. The hindrances, which we dealt with last month, the five aggregates of clinging, which Lauren and I are going to be covering in October, dependent origination, which we studied with Tim and Tuari all last year, the Four Noble Truths, and tonight's topic of the seven factors. So the fourth foundation is some pretty heady stuff. The Buddha called these seven factors the anti-hindrances. They're factors of awakening. They're good news. The Buddha is known as saying that I teach the suffering and the end of suffering, and the seven factors are about the end of suffering. Before I go into my talk around the first four, I want to take a minute about just to reflect on the word awakening. Sometimes this list is called the seven factors of enlightenment, and I prefer the word awakening because it's an active verb, and enlightenment is a noun and kind of can be seen as kind of steady state. And I think this whole process of awakening and freedom is a process. It's a process of waking up from delusions, from ignorance, from being lost in old habits and beliefs, and waking up from wanting to change what this moment, or believing that the next moment's going to be better. And so as I speak tonight, and then Susan will share in a while, perhaps you know, also reflect on what are some of your thoughts about awakening. For me personally, I really have grown to believe very much in the possibility of awakening, because I've had these little moments, moments where I could actually feel the freedom from not being so tied to my old ways of thinking and responding to experience. And Joseph Goldstein talks about awakening as small moments many times, and that certainly has proven to be true in my own life. Sometimes in the suttas, the stories of awakening are like these lightning bolts, you know, and somebody hears a talk and then next moment they're enlightened. And whatever your view is, there's this whole continuum. And for me, it's much more of a process. So as we both have said, they're the antidote to the hindrances. The hindrances that create a veil or a block to really clearly seeing. And the seven factors address this process of where the obstructions are not present, and there's an openness to clarity. We're encouraged to starve the hindrances and feed the seven factors. Sometimes these factors are called really good friends. Guy Armstrong says that along with the Brahma Viharas, the metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, the seven factors are your best friends. And sometimes they're called good news. So it's kind of, it's not that the idea of good news is that all of a sudden life is going to just be hunky-dory. You know, life is still imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. And so life is still going to be difficult. It's still going to have its ups and downs and worries and pains and all of that. But the reason that the seven factors, I think, are called good news is it kind of shows us the lunacy of our striving for happiness in and through things that don't last and aren't really going to give us what we want. And these teachings invite us to really fully experience all of life, the imperfections, the ups, the downs, the moments of hurt, frustration, fear, and also all the moments of joy. One of the teachers in this Theravadin tradition, Anilayo, he says that the very presence of these factors in our minds testifies to our capacity to awaken. However weak they might be, they can become stronger through practice. And the Buddha is known to have said, and I have always found this to be very encouraging, that he wouldn't have asked us to do this if he didn't believe we could. So this process of awakening, of freeing the mind. As Susan said, there's three sections of the factors. The first, mindfulness, has its own section. Then there are the arousing factors of investigation, energy, and joy. And then the calming factors. And I'm going to be talking about the arousing ones. They are sequential, but they also kind of build upon one another and feed each other. But you'll see as we're talking tonight how they really do feed into the next one. So mindfulness, you know, it's part of our nature and our basic capacity to be mindful, to be aware of what's happening in the moment. We don't have to like go search for this capacity. It's already here and we use it all the time. You know, we watch a TV show or a movie, we play a musical instrument, we participate in sports, We read a really good book. We have a great conversation. We're involved with someone. I mean, there's all these ways that we already know how to be mindful. Nearly every Buddhist teaching and all of these different lists, mindfulness is one of the pieces of it. Because it's without it, nothing else can really happen. And mindfulness, it's the non-judgmental present moment awareness of what's happening in this moment and in the next moment and the next. It's the acknowledgement of the truth that life unfolds moment by moment. And so mindfulness is that capacity that we all have of being awake for this unfolding of moment to moment. Not trying to change or fix the moment, just being with what is happening and seeing it, feeling it, investigating it, knowing it, and leaving it alone. We see through mindfulness, this non-judgmental present moment awareness, we see what's happening in the midst of all conditions. And mindfulness is seen within the seven factors as the balancing point that balances between the arousing energy and the calming energy. So even though it comes first, it's also all the way through all the other six. So investigation, a good way of thinking about it is be curious. You know, when you first learned how to meditate and your teacher would probably say, bring some curiosity to what's happening in the body. Bring curiosity to what's this breath and how is it? Is it long? Is it short? Is it deep? What's your natural breath? Just that bringing that curiosity, that interest to whatever is happening. And so with the seven factors, we go a little deeper than just that initial interest or curiosity. We really ask a lot of questions of what's going on here? Are we just stuck in our old habits and beliefs? Are there just patterns that we're repeating over and over again? In the teaching, sometimes the image is used of a magnifying glass, of a way of really looking in and seeing all the details. For me, what I like is the image of expanding our peripheral vision so that we see outside of what we usually see. Because sometimes it feels like we've got these little blinders on and we only see this much. So that investigation can deepen and broaden past our old notions of what this moment is really about. You know, as children, I think all children make certain decisions kind of based on our whatever emotional experience we're going through. And then we get to be adults, and sometimes we realize we're still living out those same old childhood decisions. For me, partly out of just because of my family of origin, of what was going on, I made a decision as a little person to be happy and see the positive in everything. And I think part of it is my mother was really depressed, and so I was kind of like the counterbalance to that. And, you know, there's been some good benefits from having that kind of outlook. But once I started a practice and I realized that how important it was for me to understand dukkha, to really understand the unsatisfactoriness, the insubstantial nature of experience, of the impermanence of things. If I was always seeing only the upbeat, everything's lovely kind of perspective, I was missing out on a lot. I was missing out on really understanding some of what is actually happening in life. So I've made, through my investigation and through the practice, I've been able to I'm still basically a pretty upbeat, glasses half full kind of person. You know, I probably will be for the rest of my life, but I've made more intentions about, in certain circumstances, to broaden my perspective. It's come from that investigation. The next one is energy. It's just right energy. And it's energy for the practice. Just the right amount, not over striving, not that kind of like, oh, I'm going to get this and my mind's not going to wander and I'm going to stay on my breath. It's not that kind of over striving. It's just that kind of right amount that allows you to be mindful in that non-judgmental, present awareness way, be curious, and feel the energy that comes from that curiosity and mindfulness. Energy is what really makes the continuity of practice possible. One of the teachers in this tradition, Guy Armstrong, he says that mindfulness is not perpetually continuous. It's not, you know, we're not Buddhas or Arhants, at least not yet. Maybe we will be. But it's about as frequent as we can make it happen. We bring as much effort as possible, as frequently as possible. And this kind of energy really helps sustain our practice. It allows for full engagement with the practice. You know, the investigation and arousing that curiosity, it also arouses that energy. And we use that process of asking questions. And as a result of that, we are energized. The last of the arousing factors is joy. And it's really delight in the practice. You know, sometimes the teachings of the Buddha can seem a bit of a downer. You know, I teach suffering and the end is suffering. But there's so much joy that comes from the practice. And Gil Fronsdale, another one of our teachers, says he describes this joy because we are so engaged. We're so engaged in life. We're so present for it. There's a kind of joy that just comes from that kind of presence. Couple other examples from my life. I was the youngest of three. My mother was widowed very young, and my oldest sister was disabled. And I made another one of those little, you know, childhood emotional decisions that other people's needs were so important. This young widow with three kids and my sister who was disabled, that my needs weren't really very important. And that filter kind of guided me through my 30s and into my 40s. And I remember the time once when I was involved in a situation where there was some conflict or rub going on. And of course, you know, the filter comes out. My needs aren't important here. I need to, you know, just respond to what's happening there with others. And there was this little voice. I call it the Dharma voice. It's Philip Moffat says, the Dharma does you. And the Dharma was doing me in that moment. And it said, Suze, that's not what this is about. And it gave me that opportunity to investigate really what was going on and to bring that good curiosity and energy. And for me, it really was like a lightning bolt, because I thought, what, you mean I can actually see this differently? And it felt like such a moment of freedom. I still have that filter is still my default, but I now know that it's not the only filter that's there and that there are other ones. And I really experienced a great amount of joy. Another example just happened last week. I went to Cloud Mountain for a retreat with Tim Guile and Narayan Levinson. And you know how you go on retreat, for those of you who have, and you're a little nervous to begin with. And even though I knew I was going to know people there, I was just, you know, what's going to happen? How's it going to be? And I'm standing waiting to register. And this woman says, Suze, hi, I'm Tamira. And I look over at her and I go, Tamira, it's so good to see you. Well, we've never met before. She lives in Hood River, Oregon. I live up here. But we sit together every Tuesday morning with Tim in the Tuesday morning drop-in sit. And there was like this instant feeling of sangha, this instant connection with another practitioner, and that joy of practicing and going, oh, right, I'm going to be for 7 days with a whole bunch of people who are doing the same thing I'm going to do. So that kind of joy in the practice is really what we're talking about. So joy and joyful interest arises from full engagement, from full investigation, from bringing our best energy. And we can take delight in those moments when we're really present, when we're seeing what's actually happening, when we're aware that the old beliefs, I can just set those over here because they're not letting me really see what's going on. And you can see how it's sequential, you know, how mindfulness, letting things be, really seeing what's going on. Then you go into, okay, I'm interested in this. What's happening here? What's happening in my body? What's happening in the mind? How, you know, am I trying to change things, fix things? What's my energy like? And, you know, is there some real feeling of engagement with life? So these are the arousing factors